From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Five men behind the Madrid subway bombings and eight men who went to Iraq to wage jihad against Americans came from one town in Morocco. What's going on in this town? On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter Andrea Elliott about her New York Times Magazine cover story where boys grow up to be jihadis. Also, Joel Hovenstein tells us about the year he spent working with a private contractor in Afghanistan, trying to create jobs that would provide alternatives to growing poppy. But there were big problems. There was no good way of getting money from Washington to the Afghan frontier, and his men were attacked. Also, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews a new reissue by Dewey Redman. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Five men involved with the Madrid subway bombings of 2004 and eight men who set off for Iraq to wage jihad against Americans came from one small town in Morocco called Tetouan. Most of them were from a neighborhood within it called Jemaah Mazouak. Why is this town turning out terrorists? That's what my guest, Andrea Elliott, investigated in her article, Where Boys Grow Up to Be Jihadis, which was the cover story of this week's New York Times Magazine. Elliott won a Pulitzer Prize earlier this year for her series of articles called An Imam in America. The town of Tetouan is on the northern tip of Morocco, just a few miles from the Mediterranean Sea, not far from Spain. In fact, many young men leave Tetouan to find work and new opportunities in Spain. Elliott went to that town to interview family, friends, and neighbors of the jihadis. I asked her if there was any connection between the young men from Tetouan involved in the Madrid subway bombings and those who set off for Iraq.
There were several connections between these two groups. Two of the men who had died in Madrid after carrying out the attacks had a brother who remained in Morocco, who eventually was arrested along with a number of other people, and charged with recruiting and financing for this group of men who inevitably ended up going to Iraq. The more meaningful connection between these two groups, I think, was a connection of ideology and influence. I would say that there was a bit of a domino effect in this neighborhood, because when news of the bombings in Madrid hit, while most people were that I talked to were really, really shocked and appalled, some of the young men in the neighborhood just became curious about the jihadi movement. And that curiosity wasn't just a kind of random general curiosity that one might have, but a very personal curiosity, given that they knew these men, some of them knew these men in Madrid and had really grown up alongside them, and in a sense felt that they knew their hearts. And as horrific as this violence may have seemed to a lot of the people around them, I think that there was the notion that because they knew them, their motivations couldn't have been all that misplaced. So I think it just really planted a seed or even just a question, which was, why would these guys we know in Madrid do this? And kind of just set them on what was really a new course for them, because in Morocco, terrorism is still largely a new phenomenon. The first major event in Morocco since its independence was the suicide bombings in Casablanca in 2003. So while you've seen certainly, you know, exported jihad, Moroccans going to places like Chechnya and Afghanistan, a small number of them, this event in Madrid was really anathema to people and shocking. And yet, I do think it sort of planted a seed in the minds of some of these kids.
Well, what was the new course that set them on? How did their lives change after they saw the results of the Madrid train attacks?
They became really consumed by news of the war. I think it sort of set them on two tracks. First, they just wanted to understand what this whole jihadi movement was about and became very focused on understanding more about what the Quran says and the Sunnah, and began talking to an imam in the neighborhood who, by many accounts, including the Moroccan government officials I talked to, was very influential on them. But at the time, they were sort of comfortably, quietly talking about this, and it was just interesting for me to see how they connected the dots, taking the war and what they felt outraged by, namely contractors profiting off of Iraqis, off of the war itself, and also, you know, videos that they had come across on the internet, because at a certain point, television coverage became insufficient. So these images that they would see of soldiers barging into homes, taking all of that stuff and applying it to a larger ideology that kind of says the West is at war with Islam. The war in Iraq is not a kind of confined conflict, but a global struggle.
Now, what about their mosque? You write that their imam ended up being a recruiter for jihadis in Iraq. He arranged ways for these men to journey to Iraq. Tell us a little bit more about what you learned about their imam.
The imam was very popular in the neighborhood among some people because he was young and really affable, and he recited the Quran with a very melodious voice, and people were taken with him. He led prayers at a mosque that was never given the official government stamp, and he would talk to the young people who came to his mosque in the evenings, and he was sort of like a friend and brother to them, and in some ways stood in contrast to the other imams in this neighborhood. This neighborhood has a lot of mosques, at least 10 by my count. And the older imams, I think, were perceived by some of these guys as sort of stiff and set in their ways. And this guy was just, something about him, I think, struck them. A lot of people I talked to, their eyes would light up when they described him, even though he's now in jail. And the Moroccan authorities claim that he's the recruiter. Somebody with a lot of information about this group, who was very good friends with a lot of them, who I talked to at length, believes that, yes, he may have actually connected them to people who were financing and arranging these trips, but didn't recruit them, that they really essentially recruited themselves and found a way to get there through him. Exactly how he fits into this, I think, remains a bit of a riddle.
Why is he in jail?
After these five men left the neighborhood, and news of this began to spread, the Moroccan authorities just set out to crush this and arrested a number of people, more than 20 people, including the imam, from around the country, not just in Tetouan, and charged them with arranging trips and financing them into Iraq with the assistance of al-Qaeda in North Africa.
Did these young men, before leaving for Iraq, tell their families where they were going and why?
The sense I got was they actually took pains not to tell anybody where they were going, possibly because they felt that it would endanger their families. This is a country that has dealt with quite an aggressive approach by the government in prosecuting terrorism. And they just also didn't want anything standing in between them and their voyage. So news really came to the families once they had left. A number of them called home and asked for forgiveness. And
forgiveness for what?
Well, it's an interesting question because the phrase that they used, translated in English, reads, "Forgive me if I have done you wrong," or "Forgive me my mistakes." And this is a phrase that one hears commonly in the north of Morocco when people are saying goodbye before going on a long journey. So it's not entirely clear. There are a lot of rules, none of them official necessarily, but the mores of this whole jihadi movement are still taking shape. And a lot of people believe, for instance, that it's important to ask your parents' permission before leaving, to pay off your debts, and to pray, to be a good person. So I think that possibly some of it was that they hadn't asked for permission, and this is something that they were criticized quite a bit for in the neighborhood after leaving.
What do you think their expectations were about what they would do in Iraq? Do you think that they went with the idea of becoming suicide bombers or of something else?
Exactly what they expected, I don't think we'll ever know because they're missing, with the exception of two who appear to have been detained in Syria. But the sense I got from people who knew them really well was that they were prepared to be quote-unquote martyrs, that they were prepared to give up their lives in order to defend Muslim land. The sense I got from talking to U.S. military officials is that many of the foreign fighters who get to Iraq arrive with this notion sold to them often by imams in their hometowns, that they will be fighting some kind of heroic battle, only to find that they will, in fact, be deployed on suicide missions targeting other Muslims. And many officials have asserted, U.S. officials, that the majority of these attacks are carried out by foreign fighters, the suicide attacks directed at other Muslims. And so there may be a real degree of deception or disillusionment in terms of what people wind up doing versus what they expect. But in the case of this group, it's not clear exactly what they expected to do.
Yeah, I know you mentioned that a lot of the foreigners who go to Iraq to fight jihad or deployed as suicide bombers against other Muslims. But in the case of this group of young men who came from the small town in Morocco, their imam told them that Shiite Muslims weren't genuine Muslims, that they were basically unfaithful.
Yes.
So I'm thinking maybe they wouldn't have been that upset if they were in a suicide bombing against Shia.
That was an anecdote that really stood out to me as meaningful, because certainly people must realize, and certainly by the time that they left, they should have known that a lot of these attacks were directed at other Muslims. This is no secret. And the fact that he felt this way and that he had a role of influence in their lives, I think, certainly indicates that they may have agreed that such an attack would have been okay.
So how many people from Tetouan in Morocco who set out for Iraq to become jihadists actually made it to Iraq?
Well, we don't really know. Eight set out to Iraq, and two of the eight were detained in Syria. Some of the others did make it in. Their identities have not been confirmed to me. One senior military official told me that possibly some of them had either died or been detained, but exactly what happened to them isn't known. There was a raid in September of a militant safe house of sorts in Iraq, where soldiers seized a trove of documents that looked like kind of like intake forms for foreign fighters arriving in Iraq, with their names and their countries of origin and how much money they had and details about their families. And some of these forms were found for at least some of the five men from Tetouan who had possibly made it that far.
My guest is Andrea Elliott. We're talking about her New York Times Magazine cover story, Where Young Men Grow Up to Be Jihadis. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Pulitzer Prize-winning New York Times reporter Andrea Elliott. She wrote the Times Magazine cover story, Where Boys Grow Up to Be Jihadis, about a town in Morocco that seems to be breeding terrorists. Most recently, eight men from the town left for Iraq to wage jihad against Americans. The men from this town in Morocco were inspired to become jihadis in part because other men from their neighborhood had been behind the Madrid train bombings in 2004. And those men really went up in a blaze. I mean, they were in a house together when the police were about to break in, and they blew themselves up. And some of them, shortly before they blew themselves up, were on the phone home saying goodbye. So it was a really dramatic end to a really dramatic story, and in the minds of these men, a very successful story, because they pulled off this horrible attack in Madrid. Now, the men from this town who went to Iraq kind of fizzled. Nobody really knows what happened to them. Nobody knows if they succeeded in accomplishing any attacks in Iraq. So what's their legacy in this town? Do you think they're inspiring more jihadis or not?
I think it's hard to say. Certainly, in the wake of their departure, there's been such a focus by the government to clamp down on this that it seems to have stemmed the flow, at least according to officials and locals I talked to. They didn't leave behind any videos, as far as I know, and there are no posters, for instance, exalting them, because, as one person put it to me, such a thing would be forbidden in Morocco. I think that people in the neighborhood are, in large part, very bothered by it, but certainly they have their champions. The Madrid bombings, I think, brought a much more unanimous kind of disapproval and dismay on the part of people in this neighborhood. I encountered more nuance in the descriptions of how people felt about the Iraq group than I did about the Madrid group.
What do you mean?
Well, it's funny. The Madrid group, everyone kept telling me when I interviewed people about this sort of again and again, that they're terrorists, that what they did is awful, that killing innocent people is not jihad. And I think that the reason they feel this way in large part is because this region of Morocco, and in particular this city, is very connected to Spain. A lot of people have family living in Madrid who could have been affected by the bombings. They feel like they're a part of Spain in some ways. So they're very disapproving of that. But when it comes to the Iraq group, I just detected, you know, more hesitancy to write them off as terrorists. A lot of people that I talked to felt that they really qualified more as resistance fighters, not as terrorists. One person in particular comes to mind because this neighborhood really has a love-hate relationship with the United States. And this one person who's a wedding planner, a young guy, went to great pains to explain to me why these guys were resistance fighters, not terrorists, that they were defending Muslim land that had been taken. And we got into long debates about the meaning of jihad. I wanted to understand what he meant. And at one point I asked him why they couldn't have done a different kind of jihad to work to improve the conditions of their lives, for instance. And his response to me was, well, why didn't George Bush work on the United States? He went and occupied Afghanistan instead. Yet a few weeks ago when I checked in with him, he rather gleefully told me that he had applied for the visa lottery to come live in the United States. So this is the kind of duality that I encountered again and again in the neighborhood. It's just an interesting chasm in the neighborhood between how they feel about U.S. foreign policy and how they feel about American culture. And
well, I think this ambivalence about America can also be summed up in things like popular culture. I mean, you describe how, like, one of the suicide bombers in the Madrid attacks who came from this town wore his hair like John Travolta. I'm not sure from which movie.
Saturday Night Live. Saturday Night Fever. Sorry. Yeah,
Saturday Night Fever. Some of them listened to hip hop. I mean, you know, they liked a lot about American culture. And this, you hear a lot about this among militant Muslims that, you know, that on the one hand, they emulate American popular culture. And on the other hand, they hate so much about America and want to kill Americans in Iraq.
Yeah, I mean, I think the line is drawn between culture and policy. And this is what I encountered again and again and again in this neighborhood, was just this real love-hate relationship with America. The most popular spot to congregate for men is Chicago Cafe, right in the middle of the heart of Jemima's Walk. Yet, as soon as I would tell people where I was from, they immediately wanted to talk about the war in Iraq. And I just heard again and again, you know, your president is the biggest terrorist in the world. One man who told me that was wearing a baseball cap with America spelled across the front in gold as he said this. So there is this real duality there. And I'm sure that some of these men who turned to terrorism in both the Madrid and Iraq groups from this neighborhood lived that very much. In particular, one guy who dreamed of being a stand-up comedian and wrote his own songs and listened to 50 Cent and Eminem and had a song by Eminem that derided President Bush translated into Arabic. There's just a real engagement in American culture and rejection of the United States in terms of its policy.
Were you able to talk with mothers of the suicide bombers or would-be suicide bombers?
Yes.
Tell us some of the responses you got from mothers about their sons' actions.
There was a tremendous amount of resistance to believing this could be true and just enormous grief. I kept hearing, he's coming back. He really went to Spain. I see him in my dreams walking down the road, Eunice Ashbach's mother told me. You asked about the legacy earlier. One of the hardest things about the fact that we don't know what happened to them is the kind of tricks that this plays on the minds of their relatives and the people that they left behind, because they can't quite close the door. They just don't know. One mother said to me, I just want to see a piece of his bone. That's all I want to see, just to be sure that he did this. The mothers I talked to were really horrified by the notion that their sons would be capable of this kind of destruction and violence. And, you know, one mother said to me, if your child has a fever, you can feel it. You know, how couldn't I have felt it if they were dead? So I think that they just don't want to believe it.
So what do you feel like you walk away knowing that you didn't know before, after investigating this story?
One of the things that always frustrates me, and I think a lot of my colleagues, about terrorism coverage, because it's the position that we're placed in after a big event happens, is how little is understood about these people. So either they've killed themselves and you can't get to them, or they're locked up because the plot has been foiled. And in the aftermath of whatever event it is that you're covering, people are understandably scared. And so you don't really get much of a sense of who they are. And there are plenty of people who are members of groups or who belong to groups of circles of friends who sympathize with this and who don't actually follow through. And I guess I don't feel fully satisfied that I understand what it is that, you know, enables someone to actually be willing to give up his or her life. I did get the sense with one of them that there was a lot of trepidation and second guessing and doubts after he left Morocco, because he called back 5 or 6 times from Syria to his home. And this was one of the more powerful things that I came across in talking to people who knew him well, including family members, was that he just seemed so distant on the phone. He was trying to pretend that everything was normal and asking questions like, had his brother done his homework? And yet he was about to go kill himself or potentially die fighting a battle that it sounded like he was suddenly worried he should have never signed up for. So I guess I have a lot of questions about what happens once they do jump cross over the line, not just what pushes them over, but then once they get there, what is that process like? And those are things that I wish we knew more about.
Andrea Elliott, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Andrea Elliott is a reporter for the New York Times. Her Times Magazine cover story, Where Boys Grow Up to Be Jihadis, was published Sunday. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble and the Barnes & Noble Review, the new online literary magazine with reviews, interviews, and recommendations. From 20th Century Fox Home Entertainment, presenting The Namesake, a vibrant coming-of-age story starring Cal Penn, now on DVD. And from Dial Press Trade Paperbacks, publisher of the new paperback editions of Felice and Forms of Shelter by Angela Davis Gardner. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
It sounded like a great project, creating jobs in Afghanistan that would offer a financial alternative to growing poppy. But there wasn't even enough security to protect the people working on the project. Coming up, we talk with one of the project directors, Joel Havenstein, author of Opium Season. Also, a review of a new Dewey Redman reissue. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Joel Havenstein went to Afghanistan in 2004 for a worthy project, but without the resources to accomplish the goals. The project was to create jobs that would provide an alternative to growing poppy. The Afghan government had promised to eradicate the opium poppy fields in the Helmand province. The U.S. Agency for International Development had hired a contractor to create jobs that would provide economic alternatives to poppy. Havenstein was hired by the contractor as deputy leader of the project, running the operational side. To meet payroll, he had to find ways of moving $1 million in cash each month to the Afghan frontier, a place without banks. Before he had a safe, he carried thousands of dollars in his pockets. His job ranged from planning work sites to buying shovels. His new memoir is called Opium Season. Jill Havenstein, welcome to Fresh Air. Would you describe the goal of your project in Afghanistan during the period that you're writing about?
The goal of our project was really to provide a temporary cushion for the rural economy in Helmand Province. USAID knew that they didn't have alternatives in place to offer the farmers, alternative crops, alternative sources of credit, alternative ways of farmers to make a long-term living. And so for that first year, before they had a chance to introduce those long-term alternatives, they ordered a couple of USAID contractors to go into the provinces with the most poppy cultivation and to just create short-term cash jobs, a sort of a New Deal-style project where you got tens of thousands of Afghan farmers, gave them picks and shovels, and sent them out to fix up the canals, to fix up the roads, to do, in a sense, deferred maintenance on these things that hadn't been, that had just gone into extreme disrepair during the war years in Afghanistan.
Now, a question you raise in your book is, why would a farmer give up the perfect crop? Why is poppy the perfect crop in Afghanistan?
Well, in Afghanistan, because of the long war years, a lot of the orchards growing fruits and nuts that farmers made their living off of before the war were destroyed or mined. The roads were wrecked. Electricity was wrecked over most of the country. And so you really need a crop that doesn't require refrigeration, that can be transported over bad roads without bruising or falling to bits, and then can be sold on international markets. And opium fits that bill perfectly. Also, because of the way the whole rural economy is structured, a lot of the poor farmers there can't get access to land unless they grow poppy. The landlords will order them to grow poppy on this sharecropped land. And they don't have access to credit. They can't get loans to tide them over from when they plant to when they harvest. And the poppy traffickers will pay them at the time of planting for a certain amount of opium at harvest. So in all those ways, poppy is better suited than any other crop right now for farmers to make a living.
So how many jobs did you have to create, and how much money did you have to pay in this attempt to lure people away from growing poppy?
Well, our aim was to pay more or less 50,000 people over the course of 1 year. We were basically going to pour about $10 million in salaries into the province. Now, if there'd been a thoroughgoing poppy eradication program in the province, that wouldn't have actually made up more than $10 million, well more than $10 million, is involved in Helmand Province in the poppy industry. But we thought that if there was some attempt at poppy eradication, we would try to fill the gap with cash so that the bottom didn't just drop out of the rural economy along with the poppy.
One of the biggest problems you had, perhaps the biggest problem that you had, was security. What are some of the options that you had for providing security for your men and for protecting them, for protecting the payroll?
Well, a lot of aid agencies in Afghanistan choose to go largely unprotected in their work on the idea that if you have men with guns, you're more likely to make a target of yourself. And initially, we tried to keep a pretty low security profile. When we sent payroll teams out to pay our workers, then we would send police along with them, local police. But for the most part, we tried to get by without armed guards for most of the time. And this was at a time when Helmand Province was a relative oasis of calm in the south. So it wasn't crazy to think that we could do that. A lot of other groups down there did. But we quickly found that because our payments were getting us into political feuds, we'd go to a district and unbeknownst to us, would be paying perhaps more people from one clan than another. and that would put our guys in danger. And we eventually got a carjacking in which a couple of our engineers were briefly abducted from one of our work sites. And after that, it became clear that we would need to take stronger measures to protect our staff.
So what are your options in terms of hiring security?
Well, at that point, you have the option of hiring a private security company. I mean, we've probably all heard of Blackwater and Dyncorp and some of these other companies that have a big presence in Iraq and Afghanistan. But those come very expensive, and USAID, especially in Afghanistan at that time, was reluctant to authorize the millions of dollars that it could take to pay one of those companies to protect a project. There was one company, a security company, that did come at USAID rates, but that was essentially because they just took these unreconstructed Afghan militias and hired them. So these groups weren't very disciplined, they weren't reliable, and they had their own feuds that they were carrying on. So really, some of the projects I worked with this group, and I just felt that really for our project, they'd cause more trouble than they solved. And that unfortunately left us with the only option being to work with the local Afghan police to request from the governor of the province a unit of Afghan police to act as security escorts for our project, and to do our best to train them and discipline them, equip them for the job.
How effective was that?
It was an extraordinarily difficult job. We found very quickly that the Afghan police had all the same bad qualities as the militia groups that we'd seen working with the private security companies. Because in essence, after 2002, the U.S. and NATO focused a lot of attention on reforming the Afghan army and have actually seen some fairly good results from that. But police reform fell through the cracks. And as a result, the police, even today in Afghanistan, are for the most part still militia groups, often with a history of banditry. And it takes a vast amount of work to discipline them and give them any sort of professional structure.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Joel Havenstein, and his new book is called Opium Season, A Year on the Afghan Frontier. And it's about the year that he spent working for a private contractor in Afghanistan, contracted by USAID, the U.S. Agency for International Development. And the job was to create projects that created jobs for people in Afghanistan as an alternative to growing poppy. Okay, so we were talking about how big a problem security was for you and your team. How many people did you lose?
In May 2005... our project was attacked, we were told, by Taliban. And initially, five of our colleagues were killed out in a monitoring visit to the field. And then the following day, the funeral convoy of one of those casualties was attacked, and another six lost their lives, so 11 in total.
How did you get the news?
I was at that point packing to leave. I'd just got engaged and was on my way out from the project. And I got the news of the first attack when I was back at the guest house tying up some loose ends. And the following day, after I'd been to the funeral of one of my friends who'd been killed, a car screeched up, and we heard the news about the funeral convoy, and I didn't believe it. I thought it was just a rumor that had been spread in the wake of the first attack. Then we got back to the office, and I got a call from a journalist who was with the bodies and who said that the only identifying mark on the six dead men was my business card, which is in the pocket of my friend who was killed. And that was the point at which I knew that that the project was going to collapse.
And was that the end of the project?
It wasn't the final end of the project, but we stopped all of our activities, pulled out the expatriate workers, first to the PRT military base and then to Kabul. And eventually, at this point, USAID was working on getting the long-term project going, the long-term alternatives. And they decided that they would just roll what was left of our project and its staff into the long-term project rather than keep it going as planned until the end of its one-year span.
What kind of turning point was this in your career and in your life? And I ask this knowing that you felt a sense of personal responsibility for the security of the men who were killed.
It was, obviously it was a shattering moment. I felt that I and my colleagues, you know, while we had had no good options to choose from with security, obviously the option that we ended up choosing, working with the police, hadn't been enough to protect our men from being killed. And yet, I had by that point formed very close bonds with so many of the Afghans that I worked with. And they continued to believe in the possibility of reconstructing the country. They continued to ask for me to come back and help them. I guess this was a turning point in that USAID and the State Department began talking more about acceptable casualties in the reconstruction of Afghanistan, and I resisted that and continue to resist that. I don't think that that's an approach that we can take with these Afghan staff, but I still am committed to the reconstruction of Afghanistan and to trying to make it happen in a way that doesn't risk the lives of the people that we work with.
My guest is Joel Havenstein. His new memoir is called Opium Season, A Year on the Afghan Frontier. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Joel Havenstein, and he's the author of the new book, Opium Season, A Year on the Afghan Frontier, and it's about the year that he spent heading up a project with a private contractor that was funded by the U.S. Agency for International Development, USAID. And this was a project whose goal was to create jobs for people in Afghanistan to convince them to give up growing poppy or working in the poppy economy. He's no longer working on that project, but he is back in Afghanistan working on a similar project in a different region in the north of Afghanistan. Now, Joel, you spent part of your childhood in Nepal. Your father is a missionary, and when you were growing up, you know, he was in Nepal and other countries too?
At that point, we were just working in Nepal. Since our family left Nepal, he's worked in a lot of countries across Asia.
Mm-hmm. And in fact, he goes to Afghanistan a couple of times a year, and you did some traveling with him while you were there. You write in your book there was a profound difference between what had brought my father to Afghanistan and what brought me here. What are some of the differences you see between the work that he's done abroad and your work?
Well, I think when you you look at this mission ethic that I grew up with, it's people who had a really serious long-term commitment, a vocation to help people in a particular country. And as a result, they'd go there and they would learn the language. They'd live there for, you know, a decade or two. They'd be working on, as doctors in the hospitals. My father was an engineer, building hydroelectric projects and hospitals. And by contrast, it's pretty common in the professional development industry, the contractors for USAID, for people to take one-year stints or even shorter ones. They don't learn the language unless it's a sort of regionally useful one like Spanish. And there's not a commitment to the areas in the same way that I saw growing up in that community that I lived in. And as a result, you get these turnover problems where people are always leaving and taking their knowledge with them, taking their achievements with them and their relationships. And I certainly felt bad about being part of that.
That you were one of those people who come and that go and doesn't make the long-term commitment.
Well, exactly. I mean, I've been in and out of Afghanistan since 2003. And so far, the longest stint I've worked there was the 6 months in Helmand.
But you do need to keep going back.
There's been something about Afghanistan, the beauty of the country, the friendships that I've made there, that does pull me back. And I am open to and looking for possibilities to stay there for a longer-term project that I think is really making a strong positive difference.
You know, I would think that part of the attraction of doing aid work or any kind of service work in a developing country is the sense that, like, your work will be valued and appreciated. You are giving of yourself to help others. But in a situation like yours, you're in Afghanistan, and particularly in the period you describe in the book, you know, some people really appreciate the work you're doing, but a lot of people would prefer to kill you because you're American and because you are against the poppy economy, which a lot of people benefit from, and because the Taliban benefit from the poppy. So what's it like for you, knowing that you're trying to do this, you know, service work, but at the same time, there are a lot of people who'd like to kill you for it?
In a way, it's encouraging. I mean, certainly it's frightening. But it's not that the people that we're trying to help as such are hating us and trying to kill us. The people who are trying to take over the country and bring it back to a Taliban government, or the people who want to keep the war economy of smuggling drugs, guns, and crime going, they are opposed to us and they are potentially trying to kill us. But in terms of the reward, I feel like the fact that the people we're trying to help are by and large, you know, show gratitude, and the people who are trying to derail the progress in the country are trying to kill us. You know, those are both, in a way, they show we're on the right track. It's when we have complaints from the people who we're trying to help that it gets discouraging. It's when projects, you know, you try to organize a project that has good effect, and for one reason or another, it is ineffective when people complain. You know, that's the day when you go home and feel like, gosh, what am I doing here? I should just go back and be a temp in New York.
Does that happen much?
It happens. It has happened in, I think, pretty much every aid agency and development project that I've seen. It's just not an easy thing to do. There are a lot of political forces pulling in different directions, both U.S. political forces and Afghan. There's a lot of ways for well-intentioned projects to slip up. But, you know, you do also see projects that work and have a positive effect, and those, you know, that's what keeps you getting up in the morning.
When do you go back to Afghanistan?
I'll be heading back on Friday.
Well, Joel Havenstein, thank you very much for talking with us. Good luck and be safe.
Thanks, Terry.
Joel Havenstein is the author of the new memoir, Opium Season, A Year on the Afghan Frontier. He's still working in Afghanistan on a different USAID project. He returns there Friday. Coming up, Kevin Whitehead reviews a new Dewey Redman reissue. This is Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Tenor saxophonist Dewey Redman, who died last year, had recorded as a sideman with Ornette Coleman, Keith Jarrett, Pat Metheny, and Charlie Hayden's Liberation Music Orchestra. He also led and recorded with his own groups and fathered another tenor saxophonist, Joshua Redman. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead says Dewey Redman never quite got the acclaim he deserved, and that a just reissued album from 1982 shows how good he really was.
Saxophonist Dewey Redman could be tough to pin down. A fine blues and ballad player, when the mood hit him, he could play half-hour solos full of fire and beautifully developed ideas. Even so, some jazz fans lumped him in with the avant-garde because he first attracted attention as alto saxophonist Ornette Coleman's sidekick in the 1960s. But even when he played Coleman's licks, they came out in Redman's deep, gruff tenor voice. The resemblance between Dewey Redman's and Ornette Coleman's playing may reflect their shared roots. They knew each other since high school back in Fort Worth. In jazz, to call a saxophonist from those parts a Texas tenor conveys that they have a shouting tone and a strong connection to the blues. The label fits Redman. This music is from his fine 1982 album, The Struggle Continues, just back out on ECM. It shows how versatile Redman could be, and contains what may be the heaviest blues in the ECM catalog. It's called Turn Over, Baby. Redman's quartet on The Struggle Continues includes Ornette's old drummer, the New Orleans great Edward Blackwell, bassist Mark Helias, a Redman regular and one of Blackwell's favorite rhythm partners, and the too little heard from pianist Charles Eubanks. They can push the saxophonist hard or lay back when he wants to show off his pretty tone. It's lustrous on the waltz Love Is, where Redman glides along, milking a few phrases. Redman's The Struggle Continues, with five of his tunes, plus Charlie Parker's Dewey Square, was his best bid for the widespread success that always eluded him. Redman never quite succeeded in getting lumped with modern tenor masters like Sonny Rollins, Jimmy Heath, and Clifford Jordan. In the 90s, it made me cringe when Dewey would introduce himself on stage as Joshua Redman's father. No disrespect to the younger Mr. Redman, but his dad was the man. His records could be problematic for various reasons, But the struggle continues, plays to Dewey Redmond's strengths as much as any album he ever made. That's good reason to be glad it's back.
Kevin Whitehead teaches English and American Studies at the University of Kansas, and he's a jazz columnist for eMusic.com. He reviewed the Dewey Redmond reissue, The Struggle Continues. You can download podcasts of our show on our website, freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Jonathan Minhivar directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for NPR comes from Abrams Image, publisher of Plato and a Platypus Walk into a Bar, Understanding Philosophy Through Jokes by Thomas Cathcart and Daniel Klein. From the dairy farm families who own Cabot Creamery, five generations of farming and making naturally aged cheddar cheese in Vermont at cabotcheese.coop. And from audible.com, where you can download and listen to Fresh Air in addition to audiobooks, magazines, and newspapers. audible.com/freshair. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Season 4 of the HBO series The Wire is about to be released on DVD. Many of the storylines are based on the experiences of Ed Burns, who was a cop and teacher before becoming a writer and producer on the show. On the next Fresh Air, Burns talks about his experiences on the streets, in the classroom, and on the set. Join us for the next Fresh Air.